Welcome to the Sports Pro Podcast.
Hi everyone, and welcome once again to the Sports Pro Podcast. My name is Owen Connolly. I'm the editor at large at Sports Pro. Hope you're well. Now, about 10 days or so ago, as I'm speaking, many of the biggest organisations in British sport committed to a near four-day boycott of social media. These included the major soccer leagues and teams, players' unions, a host of governing bodies, and key media companies and sponsors. They were taking a stand against the torrent of racist and sexist abuse, rape threats, and death threats that athletes and public figures in sport face on a daily basis, and the failure of social media companies and the authorities to find an adequate response. From 3 p.m. on Friday, the 30th of April, until 11:59 p.m. on Monday, the 3rd of May, which was a public holiday here in the UK, thousands of accounts went silent. So how had things got this bad? Why was this particular form of protest identified? What realistic progress can be delivered through this approach? What can tech companies, governments, and all the rest of us do better? What comes next? Sanjay Bhandari is the chair of Kick It Out, which, as English soccer's anti-discrimination charity, was one of the key influences in drawing attention to this issue and in helping to coordinate the boycott campaign. Sanjay was good enough to share a bit of his time this week to address some of those questions, and also to talk about a few of the other ways in which the movement is changing. That includes the role of Kick It Out itself, which has signed official partnerships with companies like Sky Sports to extend its reach, and appointed a new CEO, Tony Burnett, in January. Sanjay explains how, despite being a small body on the inside, Kick It Out hopes to use its network within the game and its position in the wider social discourse to maximum effect. He points to where education can make a difference, how individuals, whether they're athletes with profile or regular fans, can make their own contribution, and how other groups in the industry can be rallied to the cause. It is absolutely worth listening to what he has to say. There are some compelling insights in store. Here is Sanjay Bhandari.
This is the Sports Pro Podcast.
Sanjay Bhandari, Chair of Kick It Out, welcome to the Sports Pro Podcast.
Thanks for inviting me, Owen.
Thank you very much for coming on. We're very pleased that you could join us to talk about social media boycott, which will be the main focus of the conversation, and kind of combating hate speech in online spaces. But I also want to talk a bit more about the wider mission of Kick It Out now in 2021. First of all, just to set the terms a bit for our international audience, because Kick It Out will be very familiar to anyone involved with sport in the UK, but perhaps not so much beyond those borders. Why don't you just take a moment to introduce Kick It Out and the work that you do?
Yeah, sure. So Kick It Out is English football's equality and inclusion organisation. So we're a charity. We're an independent charity. It was formed back in 1993 at the end of the first season of the Premier League. Our founding members, who are still our core members, are the Football Association, the Premier League, the EFL, which is the English Football League, and the PFA, the Professional Footballers Association. So we initially set up in the 90s to tackle racism, expanded beyond that to tackle all forms of discrimination. And now I've been there for 18 months doing a governance and strategic review and looking at the whole organisation. Really, we're focused in the future around three key areas. One is advocacy and reporting. The second is guidance and education. And the third is talent. So we are tackling discrimination and promoting inclusion across the whole of English football. In the sort of advocacy and reporting area, we're looking at public policy. We are doing our sort of campaigning. So we launched our Take a Stand campaign to turn bystanders into activists. And that's where, things like the boycott sit. It's also, where we talk to the governments about law change and work with the governing bodies. The guidance and education stuff, we do a range of education from, the kids in the academies from age 9 up to 23 and their parents to train them on anything to do with discrimination and exclusion. So we've been doing that for several years. All the 20 Premier League clubs plus each year, probably about 10, 20 of the EFL clubs. We do things like we run a fan education program. So if someone's found guilty of an act of discrimination, but they're actually someone, you know, like a kid that abused, I think, Wilfred Zaha last year, we will take that kid and try and educate them and help them to understand the impact of their behavior. And then I suppose the final thing is talent. You know, we want to promote inclusion into the game and make the game more reflective of the people who watch it and love it here and around the world. And so we have a program called Raise Your Game, which we're expanding this year, which is around bringing new people into the game. And mentoring and some other programs which we're having a whole review of. So those are really the kinds of things that we do, but it's all around tackling discrimination and promoting inclusion, not just racism, but, you know, all forms of discriminatory abuse, and trying to make English football a place where everyone feels that they can belong.
Mm. And as you've explained it there, your role in English football is quite deep and it goes to different levels of the game. You know, and it's a constructive role, but would it be fair to say that your public facing role is broader than that? It's kind of a bit more, I wouldn't say it covers the whole of sport, but it's almost like it's a bit of a lodestar for conversations around discrimination in sport.
I think absolutely right. Probably a lodestar for conversations around discrimination in sport and discrimination in society, you know, because it's difficult to separate all of that sort of web of connections. So yeah, we do a lot of that sort of talking in public and trying to help, I suppose, guide public policy and thinking and thought leadership around what we should be doing to challenge discrimination and to promote inclusion in football, in sport, in society. And of course, recently we announced our partnership before Christmas with Sky, and that's around, you know, tackling discrimination and looking at across sport and looking at how we can be learning from what we're doing in football and try and translate those lessons elsewhere as well.
Mm. And what brought you into the organisation 18 months ago?
I was at a point in my career. I had a sort of 29, 30 year career in the city. I was wanting to do some different things and changed into more of a portfolio of other roles. You know, my background was sort of law, compliance, technology, innovation, building businesses. But I'd done lots of side hustles, and one of my side hustles was that for the firm that I was at, I was the leader of our race strategy. And we'd driven quite a lot of change in that area. I then got involved with the government on the Parker Review on Ethnicity on UK board, so the FTSE 100, FTSE 350. And I've been involved in that for the last 3 or 4 years. I then, as a result of that, got appointed by the Premier League as a panellist on its equality standard. So I'd look at the Premier League clubs and how they were doing. As part of the panel, our chair was Garth Crooks. And then, yeah, when I came to sort of moving away from my historic career and moving to more of a portfolio of different things, including some things that I was passionate about and just wanted to contribute to society, this opportunity came up and I was encouraged to apply. And so I applied. That was really how it came about. But that was the background in particularly in inclusion. But, you know, in the past, it's been building businesses and strategy.
What's your impression of it been so far of the job and of the job within Kick It Out and then the task at hand within football more widely?
Yeah, I think, you know, the organisation has been around for 27, 28 years. And of course, any organisation that's been around for 27, 28 years, you reach certain inflection points and it's time to rethink and sort of slightly change direction. And that's part of what we've been doing. So, you know, I think there's a great opportunity to do more. I think there's an appetite in football and in sports, the sort of drive towards being more inclusive, which is actually driven by much bigger global forces, big investors, The UN Sustainable Development Goals. These are sort of big issues that are applying across the whole world. And so actually it's right to think about what's our place in football and in the rest of society. And in particular, I suppose when this organisation started off in the early 90s, in a way, people probably weren't accepting there was even a problem with discrimination, and it wasn't football's fault, and we wouldn't really talk about it. And so actually there would have been so much resistance to change at that point. Not that there's nothing now, it's just that resistance moves into slightly different areas. Now you've got a slightly different challenge, which is, you know, every organisation is sort of bought into it. Every organisation's got an anti-discrimination, either a message or a policy and an inclusion policy, and they've got heads of HR and heads of D&I. And actually now your challenge is you've got this massive ecosystem. How do you get the best out of this ecosystem where everybody's engaged? And that's, I suppose, has been the shift that we've been trying to make in our strategy is, how do we become the hub, a catalytic hub for change in the center of an ecosystem, and not try to do everything ourselves? Mm. I think, you know, what I observe sort of two things coming from the outside. One is, I suppose, on the negative side, I thought I'd been in low trust environments before, but football's quite a low trust environment, so maybe puts others to shame. On the other hand, it is a distributed power network, and the power is incredible. You know, these are actually relatively small businesses when you look at some of the other industries, certainly which I've worked, but they have enormous reach and enormous impact with individuals. And so actually, if you can tap into that, that is an incredible power. So rather than trying to do everything in the middle, we're trying much more to say, how can we create things that everyone can join in? You know, the boycott, in a way, we're part of the team that's created that. But that was, again, how do you create something that everyone can join in? And I think that's a sort of philosophical sort of mindset shift as well.
Yeah, well, it's I think that's a handy bit of context for us. And as you say, it leads us into what you were trying to accomplish with the boycott. Where did that idea begin? Let's actually, before we get into the kind of organisational aspect of it, what is the experience that footballers have on social media, whether that's players of color or female players, what players and pundits and people involved in the game who have a public profile, what was the problem that you had identified?
So look, social media I suppose is the great communication mechanism of our day, right? It is the internet age finding its true communication form, right? So there was, I think, a media theorist in the 60s and 70s, Marshall McLuhan, who said that the first iteration of any new medium is normally just an imitation of the previous one. And it takes a second iteration before you get to it truly finding its voice. So, as an example, the first forms of television were really just televised versions of radio shows. And then in the second generation, it starts to find its voice. Well, our first generation in the internet age was email, which was just the electronic version of snail mail. It's really taken social media to be the way in which we truly communicate in the internet age. But with anything like that, you get unintended consequences. And what we're seeing is, you know, there are some amazing consequences. It can be an incredible force for good. We saw it with Marcus Rashford and the food for poor children with free school meals. We saw it with Captain Sir Tom Moore raising money for the NHS. When done right, it can be an incredible force for good. But all of human life is there, including the darker sides of human life. And so when it's bad, it's very, very bad, and it's wicked. And often that's what anyone playing in, working in, watching, loving the game of football experiences. So it's not just players, it's pundits, it's, you know, commentators, it's journalists. A lot of racism, particularly towards the players, but also casual misogyny, you know, rape threats, death threats, homophobia. It's all on there. And it's just the sheer volume of it. There's just enormous volumes of this content because there are enormous volumes of content online. And although only in if you looked at it in percentage terms, a very small percentage of the overall engagement gets through and is into that sort of abusive category. But when you've got 3 billion users and billions of interactions every day, a very small percentage is an incredibly high number. Mm. And so for a lot of people, social media has basically become a vessel for toxic and discriminatory abuse. Mm. And that's what it is. I had some numbers which I could share with you. I don't know if this will be helpful, actually. So this was just Facebook's own numbers, right? So they said that in June to September 2020, they took action on 6.5 million pieces of hate speech. 6.5 million. So just unpack that number. That's 6.5 million in a 92-day period. Mm. That's 70,652 per day. That's 2,944 per hour. That's 49 per minute. So every minute there are 49 pieces of hate speech. Now that excludes anything on Twitter. And of course, in relation to Instagram, direct messages, which is with the biggest source of problems, is not monitored.
Yeah.
So it's only dealing with complaints. So that means it's likely that there is a piece of hate speech, at least one, maybe more than one, every second, every day, every year. That's an industrial scale problem. Mm. That's the kind of challenge that we're up against.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, to refine that data a bit further, it's obviously targeted at specific individuals. I mean, it's just to speak anecdotally, as a male journalist on Twitter, I receive almost no kind of engagement of that. As a male white journalist on Twitter, yep, I receive almost no kind of engagement of that kind. Whereas you're aware that the women and people of color are receiving that, not necessarily all the time, but perhaps, you know, often enough that it's quite bracing. If you then add the scale of engagement that, say, a Premier League player would get, it might be one message every time they post something, which is, you know, it makes it borderline unusable, I suppose, for some people, if you're not able to find ways of processing that.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, it's you know, there are complexities because some people, you know, if you're nearer to the top of the game, you're more likely to have social media teams, so maybe you're slightly less likely to see it. But that doesn't mean you'll never see it. It just means there are times of the day when you won't see it. But there might be times of the day, particularly after a game, when you're actually engaging directly, that you will see it. And so the reality is this is a sewer pipe directly into the eyeballs of players and directly into the eyeballs of journalists and other people who play, watch and work in the game. I mean, even after the, you know, just example, after the recent Super League stuff, you know, there was actually, that caused a wave of anti-Semitism. You know, things went over the edge from robust and legitimate dialogue into discriminatory abuse, mm, but aimed at some of the owners because of their religious beliefs. And so that, you know, that's quite typical of what I suppose happens online, is that trolls go way over the top, and it isn't just players, it's anyone in and around and associated with the game.
At what point did this become a priority, or did this start becoming a priority for Kick It Out? Has there been a change, for example, with the pandemic, the fact that you haven't had as many in-person interactions, so, you know, this has risen up the agenda, or was this inevitable, basically? Has there just been such a kind of drumbeat of this kind of stuff getting worse or getting harder to kind of countenance and justify?
I mean, I talked about it during my interview for the role as chair, you know, nearly 2 years ago. So this is something that has been on the agenda, certainly for all of that time, and was growing in the years before as well. It's just that, as we've seen with the rest of society, this has grown massively in the last year because it's the primary form of communication, and it's the way in which we all experience the game now, because we all experience it online or on TV, because it's virtually possible to experience it inside the ground, you know, for you know, 99.99% of us, this is the way we consume the content. And so it has grown over the last year, there's no doubt about that. And so of course it's grown in importance for us, but it was important for us for the you know, certainly all the time I've been at Kicking Out, and my understanding was, yeah, even for the year or two before that, we were starting to see this on the rise. And actually, you know, people like Troy Townsend in our group have been talking about this 6-7 years ago. So, you know, this stuff has been happening for that long. So I think it's just, it's hit a kind of crisis crunch point because of the sheer volumes, and we're all sort of, I suppose, heavily engaged, and social media has become more and more and more popular over the last 7 years. Each year, it just, you know, the numbers have been growing. I mean, you look at it now, well, Twitter has what, 300 million users, I think, but Facebook has something like 3 billion. I mean, it's just enormous numbers.
Get the very best of SportsPro sent straight to your inbox. Head to sportspromedia.com and sign up for the SportsPro Daily. You'll get a roundup of all the biggest stories, features and opinion from our team every single morning. You'll find that all and much more at sportspromedia.com. SportsPro, connecting and inspiring the business world of sport.
I want to get into what you want to change about that in a second. We'll walk through the process of putting the boycott together earlier this month or last month when it started. But first of all, what are the options if you are facing this kind of abuse right now? What realistic options do you have for dealing with it?
I think it depends who you are. You know, if you're a current or former Premier League player, almost the best route is actually that the Premier League itself runs a sort of little investigation system. So that's, I think, what Ian Wright used last year and others have used. And that's, that, you know, because you get advantage of the Premier League's resources. So that's probably the place I'd be directing towards if you're a current or former Premier League player or a member of their family. And they can try to accelerate some of the investigations and try to identify wrongdoers and work with the social media companies. We do that as well for anyone who wants to complain, and also work, you know, complaining directly to the social media companies, which you can do inside the apps. Those are really the options. I think the major thing that I would be suggesting is looking after yourself, because ultimately, this is someone on the receiving end of this, the victim of this kind of abuse, has the potential to damagingly impact your performance if you're a player, and your mental health, and ultimately then maybe your physical health. So I think actually, you know, with anyone within the football industry, the primary responsibility is we need to look after our people and to ensure that they are getting the best support they can possibly get to help them through dealing with something like this. Because then dealing with social media, trying to get people banned or things taken down, or working with law enforcement, those systems aren't working properly. I won't want anyone to set all their store on that. So I think looking after yourself and as the person on the receiving end of it, and having the rest of football come around and help and make sure that that help is there, is the most important responsibility of football.
And in terms of the organisations involved, the social media companies have their mechanisms in place. You talked about the reporting systems and the moderating systems on Facebook. There are laws, of course, against this kind of abuse, but there's a volume problem as well. I mean, where have the shortcomings been in the system at the moment? Where are the inefficiencies, and where is it? How is it possible that you're still seeing a problem at this kind of scale?
Yeah, so you've got a number of different things. There's an internal issue for the social media companies, which is, you know, if something is not quite unlawful but breaches their community standards, so it's not enough to trigger a law enforcement inquiry or a successful law enforcement inquiry, but it does breach their community standards. Well, actually, what are those standards? Are they transparent around them? What are the processes for moderating that? How quickly do things go off? Do they work with emojis? You know, there are so many examples of things that have been staying on for months and months and months, or for the policy, that the policies seem inappropriate because they're not sufficiently cognizant of local context. Mm-hmm. And actually, that's pretty important in this kind of stuff. Then you have, well, even if it does trigger a threshold for law enforcement, can you identify the wrongdoer? Where are they? Are they in the country? If they're not in the country and they're overseas, what can you do about that? You know, actually, of the stuff that makes it through, I think something like 70% is not inside the UK. It's abroad, and actually, there's limited the things that you can do from a law enforcement perspective, where you can work with local law enforcement. If it falls within the UK, you've then got the challenges and vagaries and the gaps that there are in our law enforcement system. The laws are still predominantly made for an analog world, mm-hmm. and so they're not really reflective of the digital world in which we live. So that's why, you know, the Law Commission is also looking again at the definitions of what is unlawful and what's hate crime in this kind of context. So you've got to work with what we currently have, and then where is that offender? Does that offender, you know, if they're in London, is this a priority for the Metropolitan Police? Yeah, might be. If they're in Stockton, is it a priority for the Teesside Police? Maybe not. So actually, where that offender is might impact your likelihood of this being pursued or investigated. Because guess what? The police have loads of other things that they're also looking at, and they're where is this on their priority list, and what resources do they have? And then you have, how are they building policies, prosecution policies, with the Crown Prosecution Service? And again, which area is it? Are they all applying the same principles? No. So there are kind of gaps everywhere in the system. It is like the cheese with holes in, and there's more holes than there is cheese. And so that's why we need legal change, and we need the social media companies to up their game as well. This is an industrial scale, as I talked about the numbers before. That's an industrial scale technology problem. It's not just a behavioral user problem. It's a technology problem.
Yeah. Well, the method you used to highlight this, as we've alluded to several times, was a social media boycott from the 30th of April to the 3rd of May. So across the May Day bank holiday weekend here in the UK. And you managed to get between you. I mean, who was the driver of that particular initiative?
Yeah, success has many fathers, and failure has only one son, doesn't it? I'm sure. Look, he's genuinely a team exercise. So there really wasn't any one person that was behind this. It was genuinely a team exercise.
So maybe not a productive area of discussion, but you managed to get, the important point is you managed to get a lot of organisations involved in this. You had the Premier League, all the English football leagues and the clubs, ECB joined in, Premiership Rugby joined in, Super League, other sports organisations, media organisations as well.
It developed organically, I suppose, because, you know, I speak for myself, we've had people before, you know, so, well, let's come off the platforms. And there's part of me thinks, I've said in the past, we can do that as long as we're really, really clear on why we're doing it. If we think we're going to do that because we think it's going to give the social media companies a bloody nose, just be really clear on the context. If we took every professional footballer off, that's 4,000 people, assuming they all had an account. There are 300 million users of Twitter. There are 3 billion users on Facebook, of which I think 700 million on Facebook and 300 million on Instagram are followers of sports accounts. Even in that, with those numbers, you know, we're an infinitesimally small percentage. And so are they going to notice? And so if you want to give a sort of bloody nose to get them to the table, that they're going to be a little bit more willing to do the things we want them to do, we have to combine it with other things like, what are we doing with government around changing the law? Can we get sponsors involved so that actually they create a little bit more peril? Can we get other sports involved? Can we get other countries involved? And so I suppose that in ways, those were my kind of my conditions for, yeah, I'll do this, but I want all those things because then it's going to be more effective. and it might not, you might have to do it more than once.
Yeah.
You know, so this might be the first boycott, but it might not be the last. And so, yeah, I suppose facts just emerged that we'd been talking about it off and on for a few weeks, and then we saw Thierry Henry come up, and then we saw a couple of the clubs, I think, was it Swansea City and Birmingham City and Glasgow Rangers came off. And so I think there was this groundswell that people wanting to do something. And so, yeah, we were really clear. We said, we're going to come off, and here's the reasons we're doing it. We're doing it because, you know, it's a symbol of our collective anger at the damage that this abuse causes to the people who play in, who watch and who work in the game. It's a symbol of unity with those victims, and it's a call to action. What we're saying is, we're saying to those people with power, we need you to act, we need you to create change. And who are the people with power? It's social media companies, and it's our local government and other governments around the world for your global listeners. They're the ones with the power to do things.
Yeah. But you went into it with the, you know, the fundamental concept that this is it's a public relations exercise. It's a campaign. It's not, you know, the scale of engagement is it's so skewed against you, I guess. I mean, I think there was some stats that came out that engagement among sports fans actually ticked up slightly because it's a 3-day weekend and people are bored. Yeah. So, you know, the old muscle memory kicks in and they start scrolling on their social media feeds. But the important thing is that you had a coordinated effort, that you were able to get this story talked about on more or less every media platform concerned with sport that week.
Yeah, it was really about creating a movement and some momentum. And we haven't done all the data dives yet, but we know that we had, like you say, you talked about some of the organisations that joined us, and actually they only joined us in the last week. So we deliberately said, so we've seen some of the previous boycotts, but where a club would come off, but they came off and then that was it, and so they weren't able to communicate that they were coming off. And so we said, well, actually, let's do it a week before, let's announce it a week before, and in that period, let's just ask people to join in. And, you know, so I was out there talking a lot to try and get commercial sponsors to join in, and other organisations were getting commercial sponsors to join in and getting sports stars. And actually, that was the bit that was, for us, felt like the biggest success, because imagine if we then had 6 months to do this the next time we did one. Mm. You know, what if we did one of these in the autumn? We've already had, you know, Nike, Adidas, Puma, BT Sports, Sky Sports, we had Lewis Hamilton, we had Lionel Messi to his 200 million followers on Instagram. You got the likes of Rio Ferdinand, Jordan Henderson, Bruno Fernandes. You've got all of the clubs. You got tennis, rugby, cricket. So what that gives us some confidence, and there were quite a lot of other sponsors as well. What that gives us is a confidence that if we wanted to do this again, actually, yeah, we'll do it again, but we'll say, and so a couple of organisations said, we're going to remove our ad spend for the weekend. Mm-hmm. And one of the sponsors had a similar idea to one I'd had, which I want to pursue, which is not only let's remove your ad spend, so next time, if we don't do it for a weekend, maybe we do it for a week, but rather than removing the ad spend, don't just remove the ad spend, let's create a pot, and we'll use that pot to fund tackling discrimination online and challenging this stuff. And that's not just about education. That might be about funding private prosecution, so that actually we're creating a world where there are consequences for actions, mm. because that's what we don't have online. There are no consequences for people's actions.
Mm. So with all that in mind, I mean, did you go into this with a goal setting mentality, or was it more about coordination, communication with the people who were going to take part?
It's a little bit of both, really. It was very much a point of principle that people wanted to do something, particularly the clubs. The clubs were really keen that they wanted to do something and wanted to make a stand. I suppose what we were trying to add to that was, yeah, but let's fit this into an overall strategy of what is it we actually want to achieve out of this. We want to put pressure on the social media companies, but also to give encouragement to government to act. And it can't be the only thing that we do. It have to be all those other things that we're doing, exploring technology options, continuing some of the dialogue we have with the social media companies around those technology options, and also then continue that dialogue with the sponsors about, well, we might have to come back and do this again in years, in 4 months' time or 5 months' time or 6 months' time. Will you be with us? And we might up the ante next time. because we haven't seen enough progress. So we want to up the discomfort level, and we want to do it for a week, and we want to take the ad spend away, and we want to do this and this and this. Are you with us? So that was really, it's about testing the water to see is there appetite for that. And what we got back was, yeah, there seems to be some appetite for that.
Mm. I mean, one of the issues, I guess, with social media, when you look at something that is, it's partly a resourcing issue that they have, because in order to have the number of moderators to cover the volume of stuff that gets posted and shared, that's a big resource, and perhaps it's one that they can commit a little bit more spend to. But if it's an engineering problem, then you get into the kind of labyrinthine priority sets of enormous advertising generating media companies. What changes do you feel like you can encourage them towards? What's a tangible step that you feel like you can get a Facebook or a Twitter to take, given that you will get the kind of, well, you know, it's all about engagement, and engagement builds engagement, and sometimes things slip through the net, and you know, these are platforms that are kind of they're engineered to generate maximum attention, and some people, you know, exploit that in the wrong ways.
Yeah, of course, and you know, if all engagement, whether on negative or positive causes, creates revenue, and there is no there's no downside to negative engagement for you, then yeah, of course that's the position they'll take. And of course, so there are a number of different things there. One is actually the reason why there is no peril in monetizing negative engagement is because since 1996 they've benefited from this exemption created by US legislation that says they are not liable for anything that goes on their platforms because they're not a publisher. And of course that's precisely the get out of jail card that's being attacked by the online safety bill and by other legislation that's proposed around the world, because it's saying, no, you will be liable, actually you'll have a duty of care and you will be liable. So negative engagement won't necessarily pay because they'll have an obligation. So part of what we will be doing with this is holding the feet to the fire of the parliamentarians and saying, you need to stick with this. And I understand that it may well be in the Queen's speech tomorrow that the proposed bill will be launched. So there is similar regulations coming in elsewhere around the world, and the US, it may take a couple of years before the US get to it, but Joe Biden's talked about it as well. So regulation is coming anyway. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my experience in that, you know, because I've spent most of my career in the regulated industries, is when there's threat of regulation, what the companies do is they tend to try and do the thing that they're going to be regulated for, and so to try and stave off the worst bits of the regulation. So we expect that's a nudge that will make them do more. What is it we want them to do? So there's basically three types of things that I really want them to do. There's adequate procedures around sanctions and around transparency. So around procedures, what I want robust and reliable procedures to prevent, detect and remove discriminatory abuse before it's sent or seen. So that could be better filtering, it could be warnings before posting, could be better monitoring, could be swifter takedowns. They have this technology. They are contextual analytics businesses. That's what they are. They sell us stuff based on what I just saw, and then so they understand context. All we're saying is that same technology, don't just use the technology to sell us stuff, use it to protect us. On sanctions, there's probably two elements to it. One is, what's your internal sanctions framework? So are you using suspensions and bans, and how are you preventing re-registration? On the external, can you be quicker and more effective in cooperating with legitimate requests from law enforcement? You know, so it can't take 6 months like it has in a couple of cases. And that's where they might want to experiment with things like voluntary or other forms of verification. So, you know, when we talk about verification, you know, I try and avoid conversations about anonymity. I talk about verification. Can you verify a user so that if they do something wrong, you can identify them? Very, very often when you get into this dialogue with social media, it becomes a binary question. You either verify nobody or you verify all 3 billion users. And I'm saying, well, there's a massive grey area there. Why don't we explore the grey? So can we not have voluntary verification? So, you know, we as a group of users say we'll limit the interactions with people who don't verify. So you can see what we post, but you can't interact with us. You can't mention us. You can't reply. You can't. Can you not provide that for us as a safe environment within your environment? It's like going into a pub and there's a cordoned off area where there's a private party. We're saying, why can't we have that? As a set of users, we're asking for that functionality. Why can't you let us have that functionality to choose how we interact on your platform? You might get more engagement from us. Or you say your community standards are higher than the law. So in other words, they'll be breached at a lower threshold. Well, if that's true, when they're breached, why doesn't that require verification? So that if you go again, you can get, you know, we can help law enforcement. So there's lots of grey area other than everyone or no one. And then the last thing I want is some transparency. Publish some quarterly reports. Say, what actions are you taking to tackle discriminatory abuse? You know, what are your community standards? Publish them. What are your moderation policies? Publish them. What are your moderation processes? Are you using artificial intelligence? Are you using human beings? If you're using human beings, where are they? Are they in the Philippines in a big outsourced center, shared service center? Or are they somewhere local? Do they understand the local context? Are they trained to understand local context? Is that updated? Are your libraries of terms updated with the machine learning? All of that stuff, what are your sanctions frameworks? Give us some example cases of what's made it through, what's not made it through. All of that stuff is doable. And so all of those things are questions that we're raising with the social media companies, but also with parliamentarians and saying, if you're wanting to know how good they are when they're lobbying you, these are the things we're asking for from them. Mm-hmm. So we're going to keep score from them. Tell us how you're doing on all these things.
Mm-hmm. What are the next steps for you after this initial boycott? You talked about perhaps repeating the process, but are there moves towards a broader coalition that you can pursue this through over the medium term?
So I suppose there's two parallel things that were going on at the same time. There is, I'm having lots of conversations with various parliamentarians around helping and support the passage of the online safety bill and that legislation. And we're wanting that to have the right powers, that they have the power to supervise, not just enforce against these social media companies, that they're well-resourced, that it's paid for by the social media companies in the same way that other regulated industries are paid for by the regulated companies. So, you know, the banks pay for their own regulation by the FCA. Social media companies should do the same. They're even more well-resourced. So there's a set of conversations that are going on there. And then separately, we created at Kick It Out a football online hate work group with all of the football authorities, plus Twitter, plus Facebook. And we meet every 2 months and we have some work streams in between. The kinds of things I've just been talking to you about where we want progress. You know, whilst we're waiting for legislation, things have to improve, the technology has to improve. We're having those conversations with them. That becomes a forum where we can have those conversations and try to hold them to account and ask them to produce the goods. And of course, if they don't produce the goods, we go back and have the other conversations with parliamentarians and say, they're not producing the goods. They should have been doing more.
Hello, this is Matt Rogan. I've spent my career creating and scaling businesses in sports and entertainment. And now I'm trying to find out how businesses can best make their way through these extraordinary times. So together with SportsPro and with leaders from inside and outside sport, I've created the Playbook series. It's the place to go for agenda-free, pragmatic advice to navigate your organisation through change. Catch up on our library of articles and podcasts and learn more about how our new Labs program can help you succeed. Head to sportspromedia.com/playbook to find out more.
Let's take this back to what we were talking about at the start of the podcast, which was, you know, the context in which Kick It Out operates, the ways in which the organization is changing. You have, you know, you've been in place for 18 months. You've had a new CEO join at the start of the year, and you've talked about the need to change a little bit the way the position that it has within football and within in public life. How much is this a kind of I don't want to say a test case, because obviously it's something where you're doing meaningful work, but how much is this a, you know, an operation where you can learn about how you work in that way?
Yeah, I understand the point, actually. I think, you know, what we want to be involved in is solutions, right? And so, you know, my experience is whenever anything goes wrong in the world, there are people fall into two categories. They're either commentators or contributors. And actually 95% of the world is commentators. And basically when we mean commentators, actually what we really mean is critics, because everyone can stand on the side saying this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. Jumping in and trying to find solutions is hard, right? And so I would much rather we try and do that hard stuff of jumping in and trying to find solutions. And I think we're getting appreciated that that's what we're trying to do. What we're trying to do with the boycott is it's part of a strategy of a whole bunch of things which are about finding solutions, either with the government in terms of new legislation and working with the social media companies to find technology and other process solutions, which will mean that we can then focus on some other issues that are a challenge. And so it's the same thing with the other programs that we're trying to run and around education and talent. It's about what's the problem we're trying to solve, right, and how do we contribute to solving that. But the way in which we solve that isn't that we have to do everything. It's how do we use the power of football. So when we're trying to create talent networks to make football a more diverse game off the pitch, actually how do we engage all of the clubs in that? How do we engage the CCOs, the charitable organizations associated with the clubs, and that broader network across football and media and so on? That's the mindset shift. So yeah, I don't really see this as so much as a test case, as an opportunity to show this is how we're going to contribute going forward, and we want to be a willing contributor. And yeah, I think we've been doing that with the boycott, and we'll continue to do it. But it's been a bit of a team effort, and you know, it's knowing what we can contribute to that team. We don't have hundreds of people, but we do have. We do have some thought leadership to offer into it, and some strategy, and some and a brand and a network that counts for something. So that's what we use.
And how is the work of anti-discrimination, how is that going to change in sport in the next few years?
I think so much of it is now actually around promoting inclusion. And so you almost have to separate the two, tackling discrimination and promoting inclusion. And we're seeing with things like the Football Leadership Diversity Code that was launched in October, you know, you've got 50 clubs and organisations signing up to recruitment targets and setting targets for ethnic and gender representation in senior leadership and coaching. And I think that's the positive journey that we're on. We're in a phase where there's a growth in discrimination, as there has been over the last 5 years, which aligns with societal shifts and societal changes. And we become a bit of a lightning rod in football for the changes that are going on in the rest of society. And I think part of what we are trying to do in football is to be a leader in saying this is how we can try and drive change. So we're standing up to the social media companies and trying to drive change. The players have been standing up and shouting about what they want to stand for. And I think those are the sort of, I suppose, the positives that you take from it, is that actually I think football has been trying to stand up and be counted. Of course, we still have problems. That's not to say we don't. There are still loads of problems there that we're dealing with. But we're not ignoring them, and we're acknowledging them and trying to face them. And I think that's a positive.
Yeah, I mean, is this does it make it a more compelling lever to pull, because this is the players who have one of the things that we talk about on the industry side of things is that the players now have an outsized profile compared to where they were 15, 20 years ago, and that's growing. And the power of the individual athlete is you know, as a commercial driver, as well as creating the ability to win on the field, is transforming all the time. It's behind a lot of different business models. And, you know, if this is the first time that they've had a disintermediated platform and they're not afraid to use it at the moment. I mean, does that make what you're trying to accomplish that bit more powerful right now?
Yeah, it presents enormous opportunities. because there is that direct engagement, and they are, they've got voices, they've got a powerful platform, and of course, if, you know, almost by definition, every generation is less tolerant of abuse than the previous generation. That's just for anyone in a minority or underrepresented community, that tends to be true. You know, I was less tolerant of discrimination than my father was, and it will be the same for my nephews and nieces and other generations. They will always, they will, there's less that they'll accept, and they'll want more change. But I suppose what you do have that's different now is that platform. You know, they're not constrained so much by what the club wants or the league wants. Actually, they've got their own powerful voice, and they've been using that. So it is a powerful powerful platform. There's a challenge that comes with it, which is if you have loads of people going off in lots of different directions and no clarity about what is it we actually want, and how are we going to know when we're being successful on that. That's the challenge that comes with it, but I think we can deal with that by having that dialogue around it and trying to figure out what are those things we want. And that's what we're trying to do with things like this boycott. So we knew that the players, you know, I think would jump on it as soon as we agreed to do this. But it's really, let's be trying to be clear about what we're trying to get out of this.
Mm-hmm.
We knew when we came to midnight on Monday, the world wasn't suddenly going to change. We knew that. That was not what it was about. It's about sending a signal, starting to create movement and momentum, and starting to engage with the kinds of organisations that might send more of a powerful message to social media companies like the sponsors, and like it becoming a global movement.
Yeah. We're about to run out of time. I'd love to spend more time talking about this, but just to leave us with a thought that we can all use. I mean, you know, football stadiums are about to reopen in a meaningful way with fans going back in, and we've had in this country for about the last 5-6 weeks people playing sport again after a gap of a few months. So we're now getting back to the point where sports being experienced as a collective. What can everybody do, I guess, to contribute, and either people who are listening to this who are influential on the industry side and in the running of sport and in the funding of sport and work around football and other sports, and people who enjoy sport as fans and as players and participants. What can everyone do?
So I'll separate out tackling discrimination from promoting inclusion. For tackling discrimination, look, if you see it, if you hear it, report it. Don't let it go by unchallenged. So, challenge it when you see it. You know, that whether that's on a terrace or in a boardroom or on social media, don't let it go by without talking about it. If you've noticed it, challenge it. I suppose if you're in a ground or you're on social media. Also, if there's a victim of that, if there's a particular person that's directed to, ask them how they are. Go and talk to them. Actually, because there's so much focus on the perpetrator. Actually, there's someone on the receiving end of that. Go and ask them how they are. I think in terms of promoting inclusion, yeah, look around the room. Does that look like the rest of society? Look around and look at, you know, and what are you going to do? What's the one thing you're going to do? Just commit to do one thing. And maybe share that commitment with somebody, and do that for the next year. Whether that's, you know, if you're in a board position of power in a boardroom, if you're going to mentor someone, maybe that is your commitment. But do something to drive change, because football's really for all of us. It's all of our game. We all love it, and we should all feel like we belong.
Sanjay, thank you very much for your time.
No problem. Thank you for inviting me.
The Sports Pro podcast is published by Sports Pro Media. The producer is Ed Dixon.